This is your moment, your time to shine, your comeback. You're ready for the next step in your career, and you want an education employers respect. So you're not just going back to school. You're coming back with Purdue Global. Backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected public universities, Purdue Global is built for people who bring their life experience into the online classroom. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
Our kids have said to us since we've moved to Minnesota, we are far more active than we've ever been anywhere else we've ever lived.
Moving to Minnesota opened up a lot of doors for us.
Just this overall sense of community, of values that, you know, Minnesotans have.
It's a real accepting, loving community, especially with two young kids.
See what makes Minnesota the star of the North. New residents share why they love calling it home at exploreminnesota.com/live.
When you have insurance, it's easy to forget about your out-of-pocket costs. That can be a lot of money. How do you know you're not overpaying? HealthLock can help. HealthLock is a technology company that securely connects with your insurance and reviews your claims for overbilling, wrong codes, and even fraud. To date, HealthLock has saved its members over $130 million. To save, visit healthlock.com. Do it today before you see another healthcare provider. Hi, I'm Molly John Fast, and this is Fast Politics, where we discuss the top political headlines with some of today's best minds.
And Nazis marched proudly through the streets of Nashville this weekend. We have such a great show for you today. The New Republic's Michael Tomasky joins us to talk about the media coverage of the 2024 election. Then we'll talk to The New Yorker's Jonathan Blitzer about his new book, Everyone Who Is Gone Is Here: The United States, Central America, and the Making of a Crisis. But first, we have the host of the Enemies List, the Lincoln Project's own, Rick Wilson.
Welcome back to Fast Politics. It's Monday, and that means Rick Wilson. Let's go. We're both in terrible moods.
Fucking cranky today. I mean, we're both just like bitchy people today.
The first thing we're going to talk about here is the, oh my God, let's just get this out here. No one is swapping out any presidential candidates, period, paragraph, not happening.
You know what? I am so fucking done with these people who think I'm going to propose a very clever political strategy and say that Joe Biden should retire. Oh yes, we'll replace him magically with who? With who, you fucking morons? There is no option here. You got to dance with the one that brung you, fight with the army you came to war with. This is so goddamn dumb. And you know what it is? It's a luxury good for people who have never run a goddamn race, who've never worked in an actual election, who've never done politics at the retail level. This idea that, oh, well, it's so simple. We'll just swap out Biden and Harris for... Who exactly?
How about two white people? Let's swap them out for...
Right.
Right. This idea that there's some democratic machine that is going to go in there, right? That the Council of Owls is going to come out and be like, sorry, Biden, you're 81. We've had a talk. We've decided it's enough. And, you know, sorry, Kamala, you're the highest woman elected ever in America.
And the first African-American woman in the vice presidential position.
Yeah. But we've decided the Council of Owls, we know better because this is the Batman movie. And so we're going to swap you both out for two. It just is so insane. It's not going to happen.
I mean, I hear this, Molly, so often. I know you do, too. And my question is always, who exactly right now are you going to pick up the phone and call?
Michelle Obama. Whoa. A woman who has said she will never run for elected office.
Right. I get like, oh, Gavin's ready. Yeah, okay, great. Sure. Tell me another. Tell me any practical political person, any professional person who has been in elections, who has run a campaign, who has been a candidate in a national campaign, every single person knows this is a process that begins 2 or 3 years before the actual election day. The moving parts are astounding in their complexity and their expense and the time it takes to put them together. And the arrogance of people who believe that they've got some simple option here. Look, is it hard? Of course, campaigns should be hard. They're difficult. They're complex. And is Biden old? Oh my God, you just fucking notice now? Great, people. Brilliant. Right. So is Trump. And here's the thing that I've said to a lot of people who've done that, who've brought this up to me. And I've said, who's the one person ever in history? Now, as of right now, in the primaries and general elections, 28 people have run against Donald Trump. Who's the one person who's ever beaten him? That would be Joseph Robinette, motherfucking Biden. So they can stop this bullshit. It needs to stop. It is the most effete, bullshit, counterproductive, self-referential, home yoga dick sucking I've ever heard in my life. It needs to fucking stop.
Tell us what you really think.
I don't know. Am I being clear enough? I can't tell.
Not clear. I have a theory that I want to try out with you, which is that punditry has become completely removed from the real world.
Yes.
And part of it may be because people are not reading mainstream media anymore, right? We have a country of 330 million people, right? And a million tuned into the Daily Show. Okay. Say 20 million people watch that dumb YouTube clip of Jon Stewart saying that Joe Biden was too old. 20, even 30, even 40. You still have a country of hundreds of millions of people. And I think the pundit industrial complex is so removed from real voters that we're almost going on nothing.
There is a great gift that I have in this world. I have campaigned in 39 states. I don't live in Washington. I don't live in New York. I have a relatively greater exposure to America than a lot of people who write highly paid columns for expensive and elite publications. The stuff they think matters, and this is also the DC consultocracy, the stuff they think matters to Americans is completely disconnected from reality.
So I'm the opposite.
Yes, you are. You are. That's why we get along so well. But at a heartfelt conversation the other day with a Democrat operative, and he really spent a lot of time trying to convince me that we need to talk about prescription drug coverage and labor unions. And I'm like, what the fuck are you talking about? Have you been anywhere in America in the last 5 years? No one's talking about that. They're talking about the things on the right. They've got their immigration machine pumped up to 11. They've got their hate machine pumped up to 11. Everywhere else, people are terrified that democracy is falling apart and that women are going to be put into the handmaid's tale. This is not an easy lift anymore to just go out and do a simple focus group and go, oh, well, here's what we're going to do. This is the fun issue. Oh, it's jobs and the economy and education. No, it's not. It stopped being that a long time ago. We need to be real about what's happening in the country, and not everybody is going to fit into what clever pundits, and you and I are both clever pundits ourselves, but the idea that you can spin this thing out and say, oh, we'll just swap out Joe Biden. It's a luxury good by people who do not understand how politics works or the stakes at hand.
So 8.2 million people watch The Daily Show on YouTube, which is good. That's good. I mean, look, I think it's probably about 10 million Americans.
Look, the number one critique of Biden from all these people, here's the thing that fascinates me.
Is that he's old.
It's not, how's the economy doing? Oh, it's terrible. Biden's really fucked it up. Nope, that's not their critique. You know, Biden hasn't sufficiently, you know, fought back against Dobbs. That's not their critique. Biden hasn't, you know, been a strong leader in foreign policy. That's not their critique. Their critique is Biden's old. We aesthetically don't like old people. And therefore, we should have someone young and fresh to run against Trump, where the exchange here isn't young versus old. It's old versus evil.
Right. Well, I also think, like, voters, and again, I don't want to make sense here, but voters are old.
Yes, the average voter in this country is in their late 40s. Late 40s, Molly.
And I don't know if that's the mean mode or the median, but like my sense is that a lot of people who show up to vote are a lot older than that.
In Florida, the median voting age is 61.
Yeah. I mean, so that's the thing is like, I don't actually think people vote on ageism.
America is a post-policy country on both sides, frankly.
We Democrats are trying.
let me put it this way. Barack Obama, who was the most brilliant campaigner and candidate of the 20th century, and I mean that as a high compliment, he had a two-word policy: hope, change. And I remember sitting in focus groups trying to like pin it down. Like when we were back then, it was like, don't you know liberal Marxist Barack Obama will impose full communism? And they were like, no, I like hope and change. And on the Republican side, with Trump, it's like, I'm angry. I'm a 65-year-old white guy who drives a truck and I haven't had an erection in 20 years. Take revenge on my enemies for me, Donald.
Right. Exactly.
I've had too much coffee this morning.
Well, we both have had too much coffee, let's be honest. But I think, so I want to say, Biden is not being swapped out for Michelle Obama.
Nope, not happening.
The first person to ever tell me that Biden was going to be swapped out for Michelle Obama was Michael Moore.
Well,
Michael Moore once told me that. And I was like, right before the, it was Hillary. Hillary is going to be swapped out for Michelle Obama, or should be. And I was like, yeah, okay.
Look, I get it. People like Michelle Obama. That's fine. And you know what? She's a likable person.
I like her too. She's great.
She has not spent a lot of her post-Washington time being a terrible human being. You know, and God bless her for that, right? But this idea that any of this is mechanically doable or practical or easy, or that it will change the fundamental course of the election, is astounding to me. I don't understand what mental breakdown is happening in the heads of elite pundits who keep saying this.
Okay. Jesse's bored. He just texted me. We've done this too much. So, and I don't want to, you know, we don't want to lose the youngs here.
I know, right?
Can we talk about Fannie Willis? Because I want to talk about Fannie Willis.
Let's talk about Fannie Willis.
I'm watching Fannie Willis yesterday and I'm thinking, I don't know, maybe I'm wrong, but I'm thinking, fuck these fucking people who are dragging her through these. Like, in my mind, she was pissed, but I was more pissed for her. Like, I did not feel like Republicans came out looking great yesterday. Now, the people I talked to who were DC people were like, that was a little over the top. She should have been less enraged. But I actually think that the rage that she showed, a lot of women related to.
I actually agree with that. And I'll tell you why. Because the idea that the Republican oppo machine has come up with is, oh, well, we can disqualify her because of her personal life. Is that really the game they want to play? Is that... Right. Honestly, well,
this is the problem they want to play.
Like, I wonder if that doesn't have a certain potential downside for a whole variety of Republicans.
I mean, this is the thing where they say Biden has dementia and then Trump goes on to make all these mistakes.
Right. And then Trump goes out and speaks in like ancient Sumerian and goes, hibbity, bibbity, bibbity, boo. And people like, yes, he's brilliant.
Right. First of all, she's divorced. He's divorced. They are not even dating anymore. There's a whole thing about when she says, you know, we stopped being physical, but we didn't have the talk for another month.
Right.
I mean, it's like, in my mind, I thought, like, this is such a bad look. They're all trying to protect this guy who had an affair with a porn star while his third wife had just delivered their child and then gave her money.
Does anyone want to make an argument that Donald Trump is somehow this figure of moral probity? Anybody? Anybody out there at all? Because I guarantee you, Donald Trump. A lot of coffee this morning, kids. A lot of coffee. Donald Trump has a sordid, grotesque personal life. And in his case, the muggers are like, that's a sign of his virility and masculinity that he'll fuck anything that moves, okay, including office furniture. Oh, I'm a man like Trump. And, oh, I'm going to get in trouble again because I just used the official mocking the Trump MAGA voter voice.
Right.
The voice that got Rick Wilson banned from CNN.
I think that that's a really good point, that, you know, you have one set of rules for Trump and another set of rules for everyone else. So Fannie Willis is divorced. She's dating someone. First of all, like, I actually do agree with the people who said, like, he should have stepped down. Like, don't hire him. You have to be so careful when you're going after Trump people because they'll take everything you do and blow it up. But that said, the case here is that somehow she did something corrupt And they just don't have any evidence to prove it. And then you have this other story running in the news, which is that Trump is taking over the RNC so it will pay his legal bills.
So this guy from North Carolina that they're putting in there, yes, he's an election denier, but he's essentially fundamentally uninteresting in the RNC takeover. The fact that they're putting Lara Trump as the co-chair of the RNC, you know, Lara Trump is not qualified to run the roller meat station at a Wawa. Okay. She is a profoundly unequipped person for this job, except for the management of the grift. And that is entirely what will happen. And they're putting Chris LaCivita, his strategist, in as chief operating officer. So Chris actually knows where all the bodies are, and it can bleed the turnip till it is absolutely fucking dry. By the time this is over, the Republican National Committee will be utterly bankrupt. They'll have to sell the building on C Street. It is amazing to me what they're about to get away with here.
Just like game this out for me. You are a Republican donor, okay? Maybe you donate to Trump, but are you going to donate to the RNC when it is just in the service of Trump?
The RNC's major donor pool is going to dry up quickly. The RNC's small dollar pool has dried up a good bit, in part because the only thing that works for Republican donors now in their direct mail email campaigns is the name Trump. Ain't nobody out there going, yeah, I need me some more of that Tommy Tuberville. Ooh. No, it is now Donald Trump. Unless the email says Trump, 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 the small dollar donors go, it must be one of them cuck establishment rhino Republicans. I'm not going to vote for him, and I'm not going to send any money. So Rana, they have bled their email list dry. This is a little secret in the industry side. The RNC email lists have been sucked dry. They are desiccated. They are bled, and there's not much more blood to get out of that particular turnip.
Oh, well. Thoughts, prayers, whatever.
Yeah, thoughts and prayers. Look, there will be some money that comes in there. It won't be what it should be or needs to be. They're not going to raise $400, $500 million to fund a convention and everything else based on the fact that
they need that money for other stuff. I mean, right.
But you're not going to get it. It is also, while they're afraid and they'll give their money to Trump, they're not afraid of whoever this mook is from North Carolina.
Right.
They're not really afraid of that. They're going to spend a lot of time figuring out what the minimum dollar figure to give to Donald Trump.
Thank you.
You are welcome.
AI might be the most important new computer technology ever. It's storming every industry, and literally billions of dollars are being invested. So buckle up. The problem is that AI needs a lot of speed and processing power. So how do you compete without costs spiraling out of control? It's time to upgrade to the next generation of the cloud. Oracle Cloud Infrastructure, or OCI. OCI is a single platform for your infrastructure, database, application development, and AI needs. OCI has 4 to 8 times the bandwidth of other clouds, offers one consistent price instead of variable regional pricing, and of course, nobody does data better than Oracle. So now you can train your AI models at twice the speed and less than half the cost of other clouds. If you want to do more and spend less like Uber, 8x8, and Databricks Mosaic, take a free test drive of OCI at oracle.com/strategic. That's oracle.com/strategic. oracle.com/strategic.
Hey everyone, it's Ted from Consumer Cellular, the guy in the orange sweater, and this is your wake-up call. If you're paying too much for wireless service, you don't have to keep having that nightmare. Consumer Cellular has the same fast, reliable coverage as the leading carriers for less. And for a limited time, new customers receive their second month free when they sign up and use promo code MONTHFREE by May 31st. So why keep spending more than you have to? Seriously, wake up and call 1-888-FREEDOM or visit ConsumerCellular.com.
Taxes, fees, and other third-party charges will apply. See website for additional details.
When you have health insurance, it's easy to think, I'm covered, no worries, right? Well, not so fast. What about your out-of-pocket costs? That can be a lot of money for you and your family. And if you're like me, you can't help but wonder, was I overbilled? You're not alone. It's estimated that over 50% of medical bills contain errors. Unless you're a billing expert, how do you know your medical bills are accurate? That's why I want to tell you about HealthLock. What is HealthLock? It's a healthcare technology company that securely connects with your family's insurance. When your medical claims come in, HealthLock technology reviews the claims for errors like overbilling, wrong codes, and even fraud. HealthLock makes it easy to find and fix hidden errors, so you pay only what you owe. To date, HealthLock has saved its members over $130 million. Bottom line, insurance alone isn't enough. HealthLock finds medical bill errors before you pay. To save, visit healthlock.com. Do it today before you see another healthcare provider.
Hey guys, you know what this playground could use? A wine country, huh?
A redwood forest would be cool.
Ski slopes!
Wait! Did we just invent California?
Discover why California is the ultimate playground at visitcalifornia.com.
Did you know Rick Wilson and I are bringing together some friends for a general election kickoff party at City Winery in New York on March 6th? We're going to be chatting right after Super Tuesday about what's going on, and it is going to probably be the one fun night for the next 80 days. If you're in the New York area, please come by and join us. You can go to City Winery's website and grab a ticket.
Michael Tomasky is the editor of The New Republic.
Welcome back to Fast Politics, my bestie, and also the person who taught me to write No Pressure, Mike Tomasky.
Oh, shucks. Hi.
So let's talk about the unique moment in history we are in here.
No pressure.
Yeah, no pressure. I mean, you're not incredibly old, but if you were incredibly old. No, but you've been covering American politics for a long time. And it seems like right now we're in a period that is both terrifying and also crushingly boring. Discuss.
Terrifying for sure. Boring? Yeah.
It's not boring, but it's repetitive.
Donald Trump has become boring. Although, yeah, it's a very weird thing. He is both of these things. He's a monster who is an imminent threat to the United States, but his shtick is really boring now. And, you know, I watched a little bit of his thing from South Carolina. This was his most recent speech. It was Wednesday night. You know, did you see this jag about the photograph of him golfing and, you know, how he looked fat, and then he was complained about that. Did you see all this?
No, the part of the 17-hour speech that I watched, and by the way, as someone who has sat through these speeches, they really are like two and a half hours. I mean, they're fucking long.
Oh, yeah. People walk out now, you know, all the time. You know, you don't see that reported much, but it's true.
Yeah, because they're very boring. And he also has a couple lies he just goes all in on. And the people who watch him are like, I mean, again, this is an unfair comparison, but they're a little like deadheads, right? Like, this is their thing. This is a raison d'etre.
I think that's true of a big chunk of them. I mean, I know people that I went to high school with from my Facebook page who...
Important caveat, you grew up in West Virginia.
I grew up in West Virginia, yeah. So I know a lot of these folks were new. But I still see, you know, a lot of them say, oh, I've seen him four times. I've seen him six times. So yeah, it is a little bit like that with some folks. Half of it doesn't make any sense.
Right. But it doesn't necessarily matter, or it doesn't matter to his people, right? Because he occupies a different zone than all other normal politicians, right? He gets away with things that even people like Mike Pence, the things that Trump gets away with are not transferable to anyone else, except maybe Don Jr.
Yeah, and not even him in quite the same way. But I don't know how to explain it, but it's mystical. And that is fascist. Between the fascist leader and his followers, there is this kind of mystical, inexplicable bond that exists that transcends any particular thing the person might say or not say or do or whatever. So, you know, like Trump makes all these, he makes more verbal gaffes than Joe Biden does, but, you know, they don't care. They don't pay attention. And so it doesn't become a meme. Well, there are other reasons it doesn't become a meme, because the Democrats don't push it.
They don't fight the way the Republicans.
Yeah, they don't fight the way Republicans do on things like that. But he can say anything. What do you think he could say that would lose these people? I don't know that there's any. He could call them idiots and they'd love it. He probably has.
I mean, in all those hours of speeches, he said a lot of stuff, you know. I want to, like, talk for a minute about how difficult it is to write about what it is, this authoritarian, because it's two things, right? It's Trump as a sort of Mussolini character, Mussolini-esque character, right? Someone who is bombastic and amusing in a way that makes him seem less dangerous. That's why I pick Mussolini, because like Mussolini, obviously there are many ways in which Trump is not like him, but that sort of bombastic, humorous kind of we're all in on the joke is actually really does come from there. But I'm curious, like the problems we have now of covering this is that we know what it is, and yet it feels like there's a lot of anxiety in the mainstream media about how to not look like a partisan when covering the rise of authoritarianism. And I feel like we're maybe worrying about the wrong things. I mean, you and I are not. They are.
Yeah, right. Yeah, reporters, some reporters covering this, and particularly editors. And I think there should be more focus on editors, like specifically the people who write the front page headlines or the homepage headlines for the New York Times and the Washington Post. Those people have enormous, enormous influence. Who are they? I don't know. Maybe you do. I don't know who they are. But like, just every word they choose is so important. And everything they decide to highlight is so important. So we saw that last weekend that her report came out last Thursday afternoon. It was a big story, and understandably so. I'm not saying it shouldn't be a story. I mean, whether her was behaving in accordance with prosecutorial norms in saying some of the things she said in that report, no, I don't think he was.
Andrew Weissman doesn't think so, and he worked on a special counsel. Yeah.
You know, nobody thinks he did, but he said them. They were news, but they were news for 3 days or 2.5 days. And so, you know, I woke up Saturday morning. Of course, they led the papers on Friday morning. Then I woke up Saturday morning, getting my first coffee and walking my computer, wondering, oh boy, what's going to be the lead story? Don't tell me. And yes, Biden's mental acuity, again, for the second day running. Now, that's a choice. That's a specific decision, you know, that they made. Did they need to make that? I don't remember what else was going on in the news that day, but a lot.
Trump had rejected NATO and encouraged Russia to attack NATO allies.
Yeah. Yes.
But for not paying their bills, the irony upon irony. Yes.
Anyway, these are choices that mainstream media institutions make. And here's another thing. I wrote about this in my piece on Monday when I was talking about all this stuff. Trump gave a speech Friday night before an NRA crowd in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, and he referred to it as Saturday afternoon. He said, what a nice Saturday afternoon. Believe me, I don't have to do this. If I could believe me, I'd be somewhere else. I'd be a very nice place. But it was Friday night, and he called it Saturday afternoon. Now, the New York Times and the Washington Post both had reporters there. They both ran stories on this speech. Neither of them even mentioned that he did that. And that was one of about five guests. He called Biden Obama again and other things. None of them were even mentioned in the Times and Post speeches. Now, if Biden had done those things, don't you think they'd be mentioned in the news articles? I kind of do. I certainly do. The way they cover these things, it's just mystifying sometimes.
I was somewhere the other day with a bunch of really smart, educated political people, and they were like, well, they need to get Biden out there. And I was like, you guys, he gave a speech on Monday. On Tuesday, he spoke to whatever. I mean, you know, I watch C-SPAN, so I see all the times he speaks. And what's happened is that he only gets covered when he gaffes. So when he gives, I mean, I heard him give a speech that was a very long speech, and it was quite he was speaking quite quickly, which for me, you know, and my father, it might be hereditary. We have some, you know, we're not fast talkers. It requires a lot of like mental acuity, which I at 45 no longer have. Nobody covered it at all. And so literally I'm with all of these smart people and they're like, well, they should get him out there more. And I'm like, he's out there every fucking day.
Yes, of course he is. And now he's not out there. I will say this. He's not out there necessarily like in campaign mode every day. You know, when you're out there as president, it's not the same as being in campaign mode.
I mean, unless you're Trump.
Yeah.
Then everything is just running and trying to stay out of jail.
Right, exactly. So they could probably do a little bit more of that. But yeah, the other problem here, Molly, is like the way news organizations, mainstream news organizations define news. News, by definition, is something that is new. Now, if Trump says for the 500th time, in some way, shape, or form that I'm going to subvert democracy if you make me president again, it stops being news. I mean, it's still shocking and outrageous, and it should be on the front page, even if it's the 500th time. But news organizations say, oh, that's not news. And so that's how they diminish the threat and normalize him. Because the more he says, and think about it, it's a terrible paradox. The more he says outrageous things, the less newsworthy they become and the more normal they become. Chew on that. That's profound, eh?
That's why they pay you the medium box.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's right. The other thing that I think is pretty interesting that we probably should talk about is this special election in New York's third.
Yeah.
Where, because, I mean, again, and everyone gets mad at me for saying this. Why everyone gets mad at me for saying this, I don't know. But like, so the whole theory of the case with Biden is that Biden should drop out because the polls show he's behind. Okay. Right. I mean, that's it. That's all that, you know, and he's old. So that's right. I mean, there's not any other information here that I'm missing. Right.
No, not at all.
Okay. So this is the whole, he should drop out of incumbency, which is an enormous advantage. And he's been quite, in my mind anyway, quite a good president. The Inflation Reduction Act, and I don't want to sound too smug here, but it's actually done all the things they promised it would. But here is Joe Biden. So this whole idea is based on polls. New York's third district polls show Swazi barely eking it out. He wins by 6 points, actually by 8 points.
Yeah, no, I noticed Mike Johnson said Biden won it by 8 points and Swazi didn't. Yeah, he won by 7.8.
Right, 7.8 points. So a 16-point swing.
16-point swing, as I heard you say on TV the other day. You argued that it's a bellwether, and Mike Johnson argued that it's not a bellwether. I'm on Team Molly here. It's absolutely a bellwether. But, you know, it's also like it's instructive of the way that the mainstream media unconsciously imbibes right-wing media themes and tropes and talking points. It was the right-wing media that said this. Because I grant you, polls said it too. But the New York Post banging on about the migrant crisis and sanctuary Swazi and all this crap.
I didn't see that.
Yeah, there's a website, Sanctuary Swazi.
Jesus Christ.
So it's the New York Post banging on about all this stuff. And so they put it into mainstream reporters' heads that, oh, this is going to be all about the border and it's going to be a disaster for Democrats. And then Democrats start panicking and Republicans start looking over, as it turns out, dramatically over. And everybody expects a close race or even for him to lose. And then it's not remotely close.
Called at 10 o'clock.
Yeah. It wasn't at all close. And he won every part of the district, as far as I could see. And this keeps happening. As Simon Rosenberg keeps pointing out, it keeps happening. There was the Pennsylvania House race that night, too, on Tuesday night, where the Democrat won. That was a more Democratic district than this one was. But still, Democrats keep winning these special elections. And there really is a correlation between these special elections and how things turn out in November, because it tells you where people's heads are. And people's heads are Republicans are extreme. Republicans are against the border. They've taken away abortion rights. Now they've done this nonsense at the border where they're refusing to fix a problem that they're highlighting all the time. So, yeah, so all the what the political scientists call the fundamentals are totally in the Democrats' direction. The unfortunate fact is that Joe Biden's 81 years old, and of all the things he can do, the one thing he can't do is get any younger. If he were 75, he'd be 7 points ahead.
But it is interesting to me, the New York Times, again, which both of us have written for and both of us appreciate, and there's a lot of good stuff in there. The New York Times opinion page has literally, like, it, you know, trans panic and Biden's age. Like, you know, if I see Ross Dothart, the idea that Republicans are operating in good faith, even Ross, who a lot of people like, whatever, I don't have a sense that they're operating in good faith. I want to talk about the border for a second. So I actually was listening to the NPR Politics podcast, which can both be maddening, but also great. They were talking about how, like, there's so much emphasis for voters on the border, right? Like, Republicans, it's the same with the Biden stuff, right? Biden's old. And then Trump gets up there and says something that is a gaffe, like Saturday morning. And with the border, it's sort of the same thing, right? The border. And then it's like, well, Republicans killed that legislation because Trump told them to.
Yeah, I don't know if people noticed. You know, Greg Sargent, who now is my colleague at the New Republic, who's been your guest many times, he wrote a piece last week for TNR, picked up on a poll that said people haven't really yet noticed that this was Trump's fault. So Democrats really have to drive that home. Maybe they did notice it in the New York special district because they're paying more attention. There were ads about it and stuff.
Right. But it's an opportunity for Democrats.
Yeah, it is. It is. And Democrats, I think, again, you know, this is where like Chris Hayes went on this smart jag last night. That this is something I've written about a lot too. Republicans just kind of like reflexively assume that they represent middle America and that Democrats represent, you know, Berkeley and the Upper West Side.
Right.
Well, that is not true. It's just not true. Republicans are extremists. Their positions are extreme. Most middle Americans, most swing voters in Michigan and Wisconsin and so on, tend to support Democratic positions much more than Republican positions. They don't want extreme harsh policies on the border. They want the border policed, for sure. They want us to have a border, and they want there to be a process, but they want a humane process. You know, they don't want to treat people like dogs. They want to treat people like people, and they want opportunities for paths to citizenship and so forth.
But the reason they want those things is because they've been told that the border is chaos and that migrants are flooding into the country, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, the reality is, yes, you have to have a path to citizenship because these people can't work. So you're having these people come in, be poor, be forced to stay poor because they can't work because there is no path. But ultimately, the only way the economy survives, especially as birth rates decline in wealthy nations, is with immigration. Catherine Rampell had a really good piece about this in the Washington Post, that actually immigration is a huge economic boon, and especially in a tight labor market.
Yeah, absolutely huge. Again, I think your average person doesn't read reports about this, but they kind of instinctively know it. They know it from their communities. They know it from they see, you know, Salvadoran restaurants and so on and so on. They just know it anecdotally that immigrants add to our economic well-being. And so this is why, as I said, you know, I mean, yeah, people want a policed border, but they don't want families to be separated. They don't want what Donald Trump and Republicans want. They want a reasonable middle of the road policy. And so Republicans, no, they don't represent middle America. But that idea is fixed in the media's collective mind.
So interesting and right. Thank you so much, Mike Tomasky. I hope you'll come back.
I will come back anytime. Dear Molly, thank you.
Jonathan Blitzer is a writer at The New Yorker and author of Everyone Who Is Gone Is Here, The United States, Central America, and the Making of a Crisis.
Welcome to Fast Politics, Jonathan Blitzer.
Thank you so much for having me.
Son of Wolf. No, I'm just kidding. You're not related to Wolf Blitzer.
Right. This is a PSA. Yeah.
Right. This is the most brainworms nepo baby thing I do every day. It's like, I'm like, oh, yeah, obviously it's Wolf Blitzer's son. You'd actually be Wolf Blitzer's grandson as I was thinking about this. Very stupid. All right. So anyway, you wrote this incredible book about the border. I always wonder when books come out during the time when everyone is talking about, you know, books take years and years and years to write. So they're yes. almost impossible to time. So what happened?
Well, it's funny because in a certain sense, obviously, all of the drama and stress at the southern border right now is good for the book insofar as people are talking about this issue. The thing I was primarily interested in was the arrival of Central American asylum seekers at the southern border yeah. and kind of telling the history of how that came to be, which has been for the last decade, at least, the kind of main story of how life at the border and beyond have changed in the United States. And now that remains the case. I mean, there are still huge numbers of Central Americans from El Salvador, Guatemala, Honduras coming to the U.S. seeking asylum. But now the situation has gotten even more global. And so now the main population of people showing up at the southern border are Venezuelans. But then there are also people from a number of other countries in Latin America and in the world. And so it's kind of a collision of two things that were happening. And my sense of writing all of this was this problem isn't going anywhere. And I wanted to try to go back into the actual history and really understand some of the lives that helped kind of open up sight lines into what the politics and policy and history of it all had been. And so now there's kind of a dual phenomenon to account for. The one in my book, which is the last decade, And now we're entering kind of this new phase, which is messier and even more dramatic in some ways.
So let's talk for a minute. I would love it if you would just talk about what drives immigration here, what that looks like. So why these people want to come here and what the factors are there.
Yeah. So I would say kind of three ways of breaking that down, starting with the most recent developments at the border. So right now what we're seeing is that the world on a whole is experiencing more mass migration than it has in decades. And the people who are showing up at the U.S. southern border are people fleeing all kinds of things over a kind of a range of different countries and areas. And so, you know, you have Venezuelans fleeing a collapsing totalitarian regime, and they've been fleeing in huge numbers since at least 2015. I mean, millions of people. You have, for instance, Haitians who have been displaced for more than a decade following the 2010 earthquake, who had resettled in other countries in South America, but who were uprooted again as a result of the economic fallout from COVID. And so they're now back on the move and have been on the move, you know, for many, many years. You have Nicaraguans fleeing a repressive government in Nicaragua, Cubans fleeing a repressive government in Cuba, people leaving their homes in large numbers because of the ravages of climate change, you know, hurricanes, major storms, people have lost their homes, their livelihoods. You know, you have all of these things happening at once. And what has been going on in Central America for many years has been really nothing short of a mass exodus. And that story is what I'm primarily interested in the book, which is a story that kind of goes back to the 1980s. But the kind of primary reason, I would say, on the whole, to explain why so many Central Americans were seeking asylum in the United States, this over the last decade, from maybe 2014 up until the last couple of years, was a combination of things like, you know, massive crime, really horrific gang violence that had kind of dominated the region. And that incidentally was the result of U.S. deportation policy in the 90s, you know, corrupt regimes that the U.S. had in some form or another helped prop up and that were running their countries into the ground. And so you had kind of all of these things happening. And what the through line is in all of it is the asylum system at the southern border, which is a fraction of what the United States immigration system is. All asylum is a mechanism by which people showing up at the southern border seeking protection, you know, are allowed to gain entry into the country. The problem is that the immigration debate in Washington has been stuck for so long, I mean, for decades, in fact, that the immigration system hasn't been updated in any sense, really, since 1990. And so, you know, you have labor shortages all across the country. You have visas that have been capped, you know, visas to reunite with family, temporary work visas, all of these things that should facilitate people's legal entry into the United States and would make this all orderly and more manageable. These have been channels that have been blocked because of inaction in Congress. And so what's happened increasingly is the pressure point for the whole drama has been the border, because people who otherwise would have legitimate and good reason to come to the U.S. either seeking protection or opportunity have no choice but to show up at the southern border and apply through the asylum system, which is badly backlogged. There are millions of cases in a backlog. It takes years before someone's case is actually heard. And the worse that system fares, the better, the more of an incentive it provides to people who are desperate to come and present themselves at the border, because the government is overwhelmed, is in many cases letting people in on the idea that in several years they'll eventually have their case be adjudicated. But that's 5 years down the line.
Last week, I interviewed someone who wrote a really good piece for the Washington Post about the border, who was bilingual, really long piece. And she talked about what the fundamental problems on the border were. Mm-hmm. And she said that ultimately it came down to the fact that, you know, there's been no legislation for 20 years, no legislation, no money. So, of course, you know, you have no path. So the only way to come is to use this broken asylum system. So it does seem to me to be kind of shocking that, you know, you don't have the judges, right? The reason why this takes so long, you don't have the judges to look at these cases. It's just a money and a legislation problem.
By and large, I agree completely. I would say there are kind of two rough ways I've come to understand just the gridlock on it. The first is, without question, if the U.S. government could devote more resources to the border in the form of more immigration judges, more asylum officers, you know, more agents with Customs and Border Protection to process people who are arriving, you know, facilities that allow space in which to process people as they arrive, that it would definitely reduce the pressure at the border. But, and this is the second thing, that wouldn't be enough on its own. I mean, basically, what we're seeing now, and this gets to something you've also said, because the overall immigration system hasn't moved an inch in decades, there's no way for people to come to the United States legally, even though there's all kinds of good reasons to admit them legally. And so, right. You know, the asylum system was never meant to address the kind of scale of people arriving that we're seeing now, and honestly, that we were seeing 10 years ago. But because nothing else changes, that's the only aspect of the system that kind of gets worked and stressed to this degree.
There's no path. Turns out ignoring something doesn't make it better.
Exactly. And, you know, it's funny what the Biden administration has done, and we can talk about it. I mean, the Biden administration, it's been a mixed bag on immigration stuff. But one thing that's interesting that they've done, which kind of reflects just the general stalemate in Washington, is they've acknowledged that, look, because there are no pathways, we need, rather than to just process everyone in the worst place possible at the border, we need to give people a chance to begin to, you know, file claims and papers with us before they reach the border. And we can then parole them in. That's the authority that the president has to basically give people legal cover to enter the country. And they've done that for populations that we've seen a real rise in immigration from. So Venezuelans, Haitians, Cubans, Nicaraguans. And they created a program, a parole program, where 30,000 people from these countries can enter the country legally each month. And one of the consequences of that was that there was a 90% drop in those populations showing up at the southern border, which is to say, you know, if you create legal pathways, people will avail themselves of them. The problem is that the people now who have come into the United States through these parole programs don't have a path to legal status either, because the same forces of gridlock are at play when it comes to, you know, they're eventually getting legalized. So basically, the Biden administration is in a bind because the only entity that can open up legal pathways in a meaningful way, in a kind of thoroughgoing way, is Congress. But Congress is a dead zone. And so you're kind of in this, you're sort of in this catch-22 situation if you're the administration, where you want to make it more orderly at the border. And again, we can talk about it. There's a lot there. But you want to make it more orderly at the border by allowing people to come in a more kind of ordered, lawful way. But then they're in. And now what happens? They have a sort of temporary legal standing for, you know, 2 years. But what happens after that? That's a big question.
Right. And that is a big question. This gets to my sort of next question, which is Republicans. This is why I love Trump so much. And by love, I mean, Jesus fucking Christ. Yeah. So Trump was like, they don't need a border bill, because obviously he didn't want a border bill because he wants the border to be bad. But there are a lot of Trump people who are like, Biden can do this with an executive order. He doesn't need legislation. Explain to us why that is just not true.
I mean, honestly, and I obviously spend a lot of time thinking about this stuff, I don't even really know what they mean when they say that. They're objecting already to the idea right. that the president is taking unilateral action in the form of this parole program. So, you right. know, they want him with a kind of, you know, sweep of the pen to shut the border down, which, again, that's also a nonsensical claim. The border cannot just be shut down. It doesn't work like that. So what they essentially mean when they engage in that bit of ridiculous hyperbole is for the president to suspend asylum processing. But again, the idea that not doing anything, or the president simply vowing to be tough and to just kind of like in a symbolic gesture say, well, that's it, we're closed, which is what congressional Republicans literally say the president should do. They say he should simply just clear the air once and for all and explain to people that, quote unquote, we're closed. I mean, I've had Republican Congress members tell me this.
I love that members of Congress have told you that.
Yeah, yeah.
Are you like,
the real brain
like,
trust is weighing in on this. Yeah.
Right.
There's not any one thing the president can do to turn this around. And the things that he's trying to do, which are extremely kind of narrow and technical, but like would help to some degree, for instance, getting more resources to the border just to reduce the sort of temperature of what's going on there, the Republicans are blocking. And so it's a perfect circle. It's a perfect circle for them. They're not saying really anything in good faith here about what the president should or shouldn't be doing.
Right. But I mean, I want to pull back for a second because this is my obsession when it comes to immigration. And I feel like we don't talk about this because I guess whatever, but we actually need immigrants. You have a tight labor market. You have a population that is not keeping up with the numbers. I mean, we're going to keep people out because that works so well for Japan. I mean, what's the thinking here?
I mean, I don't think that there's thinking here. It's mind bending, honestly. I mean, there is, you know, this isn't just a kind of progressive call for more humanity. You know, this is like a bottom line.
It's a capitalist call for more workers. I mean,
exactly.
So that's what I don't get.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, I think it's kind of, I mean, this is going to sound sort of reductive and obvious, but it's sort of the baseline reality of what we see in Washington, which is just the simplest politics here of getting reelected. And people, you know, they're playing off of resentments and confusions and fears that people in the electorate have. And that's the kind of be all and end all of how they're gaming this issue out. I mean, it's incredible to see there are Republican governors, state and local officials who are very plainly saying, look, we have labor shortages. We need workers. I mean, what we're seeing right now, this is in primarily in blue states, and it, but it's incredibly dramatic. And it kind of just shows that sort of the tragedy and senselessness of what we're experiencing. The governor of Texas has been busing all of these migrants to blue cities and blue states and doing it deliberately to sow chaos without coordinating with state and local authorities. So large numbers of people are showing up in cities like, you know, Denver, Chicago, Washington, New York. And I was recently speaking to the mayor of Denver, who said to me, you know, every day, we're getting calls from employers all across the city saying, look, we have so many jobs we need to fill. There are thousands of people who are arriving here who want to work. Please help us. What are we missing? How do we connect these dots?
And you can't hire them legally because there's no pass.
Exactly. They don't have work authorization. And there are kind of different bureaucratic ways of doing that. But it's, you know, the gears of government kind of grind slowly in that regard. And obviously, you know, the numbers are overwhelming cities because the governor busing them to these cities is trying to overwhelm them. So it's just you're kind of in this bizarre situation where like the solution is crying out. No one's even got really a question about what some of the needs are. I mean, obviously in Washington on comprehensive immigration reform, that's just a morass. But in terms of some of these more straightforward things like meeting labor needs, you'd think temporary work visas, there's not a controversy on that. And if you talk to conservatives, their game, I mean, if you talk to them away from the kind of combat zone of Washington, they'll say, yeah, of course, we definitely need more temporary worker visas.
This is what the Koch brothers want. I mean, these guys are not, they're not humanitarians, the Koch brothers. Actually, there's only one brother now. And one of the things that I'm struck by is actually in these red states, you see governors changing child labor laws and lowering the fines for companies because they know that children are working in these factories. And we had Hannah Aronson from the New York Times on to talk about that. And she said they know they have children working in these factories. And that's why they're trying to lower the fines. And these children are, you know, spending all night working in factories, falling into Cheeto dusters, you know, breaking their arms, being paralyzed, trying to go to school the next day. I mean, we are in the middle of like Upton Sinclair land.
Mm-hmm. You know, when you pan out and look at the broader history, too, I mean, that's all obviously it's horrific. And it's sort of in plain sight now, thanks to Hannah Dreyer's reporting and others. You know, when you pan out, too, though, and look at the history, that there's always been that tension, particularly on the Republican side. I mean, both parties, look, have a very vexed history of dealing with immigration policy, to be clear. But on the Republican side, one of the kind of interesting strains, kind of the intra-family tension there is, you know, on the one hand, a kind of more classic nativist populist sentiment, which is sort of always sloshed around the party. But then you also have more of the Chamber of Commerce view, which is, look, I mean, this is what you're describing. There's a kind of capitalist bottom line here. Why would we block people from working in industries where there are needs? But then within that community on the right is some disagreement about, you know, the degree to which people can continue to work in an undocumented fashion. Obviously, it's easier and more profitable for big companies to not have to pay people, to not give them labor protections. That's a very scary fact. And that's been a fact for decades. The intractability of reform on this issue has also turned into a profit bottom line for companies and for Republican politicians who defend them.
Yeah, I'm hoping you could sort of give me a little something to make me not so depressed.
So I spent years working on this book, and the deeper you get into it, you know, this is a book about the history of the United States and Central America and how American foreign policy and how American politics have contributed to all the sorts of strife in the region that leads to mass migration. And so the book sort of narrates the interconnectedness of the U.S. and the wider region, but also the kind of infinite loop of it, that the U.S. does things that generate more migration, that leads the U.S. to do more hasty things and on and on and on. And I have to say, though, that the silver lining in doing this reporting for me, because obviously on the policy and politics level, it's just stunningly upsetting. And on the human level, there's just so much suffering, so much needless, gratuitous suffering. I have to say that, and this is going to end up sounding really corny, I'm sorry, but, you know, writing about people who have been kind of buffeted by these forces of history that are just so vast that no single person could keep them at bay, who nevertheless kind of refuse to be defined by those circumstances, that honestly made me, I mean, even just as a journalist, and again, I realize that this sounds sort of pie in the sky, but...
No, I'll take it.
Yeah, I mean, it made me feel like, okay, you know, there's more of a need than ever to fight on, to tell these stories, to try to get to the human dimension of this, because the politics are so stupid, but the people are so endlessly interesting and full of surprises. And that mismatch on the one hand is tragic and upsetting, and on the other does kind of give you hope.
I completely agree. And as much as I feel like it's so crushing and sad, and the stuff we hear is just every day, it's just horrendous, I do feel very much that, like, we beat on into the sea. That's a quote from Butchered, a
So we beat on.
Yeah. But I butchered this F. Scott Fitzgerald quote.
No, it's good. It's all good.
But it is really true. Thank you so much, Jonathan. I hope you'll come back.
Oh, I would love it. Thanks for having me.
And now your moment of fuckery.
Rick Wilson.
Yes?
It's time for our one segment. What is your moment of fuckery?
The one segment of my moment of fuckery this week is the inevitable moment of fuckery that is the entire Republican Party. Alexei Navalny has been murdered, and they are already like, well, you know, it doesn't mean Putin's a bad guy per se. He can't lose. He's at the top of his game. Y'all, if you're in the Republican Party and you're still kissing Vladimir Putin's ass and you're strapped and saying, do you want me to start in the front or the back? This guy.
Oh, Jesus Christ, Rick. You're offending my genteel sensibilities. All right, go on. I mean, I don't know that we need a full.
but look, the moment of fuckery is that this goddamn party, for all of its other wild sins, excesses, mistakes, errors, violations of decency, dignity, intellect, and human rights, the fact that after Vladimir Putin has straight out murdered somebody and they're still kissing his ass, but at least they have nice subway stations, right, Tucker?
Yeah, Tucker Carlson goes grocery shopping. I do have the sense that he does not spend a lot of time grocery shopping after watching that video.
I have the sense that he sends his second deputy under kitchen maid, scullery maid to the shopping.
His chief of staff. Right. My moment of fuckery is, first of all, I can't tell if I'm the problem, it's me, or if everyone else is the problem. So it's probably me. But I think I might be the problem here. But I feel like my moment of fuckery is that I feel like everyone is losing their minds over the wrong presidential candidate.
Yes. Yes, it is.
So if you're a good natured liberal, stop it. Stop it. And if you're a bad natured conservative, you do whatever you want. I don't care. You got Donald Trump. Good luck.
And my other micro moment of fuckery is that the star witness in all of the bullshit about Hunter Biden turns out to be a lying liar who lies and has now been arrested by the federal government because he's a lying liar who lied.
Right. And we're talking about Merrick fucking Garland. So, like, this is the slowest of slow rolly DOJs ever. So, like, this guy must have done so much criming for him to even get indicted. Like, right. Because this is Merrick. I don't want to put my finger on the scale. I just let people, you know, let James Comey release that fucking letter, that motherfucker. By the way, as we go on with this moment of fuckery, I feel like Jesse's going to cut this, but don't ever buy James Comey's books. Like, that fucking guy lost the election for Hillary Clinton. Thank you.
Well, folks, have a great day.
Jesse's like, I hate both of them.
Jesse's like, fuck up, both of you, right now.
Jesse's like, I can't tell which one I hate more.
Stop.
That's it for this episode of Fast Politics. Tune in every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday to hear the best minds in politics make sense of all this chaos. If you enjoyed what you've heard, please send it to a friend and keep the conversation going. And again, thanks for listening.
Our kids have said to us since we've moved to Minnesota, we are far more active than we've ever been anywhere else we've ever lived.
Moving to Minnesota opened up a lot of doors for us.
Just this overall sense of community, of values that, you know, Minnesotans have.
It's a real accepting, loving community, especially with two young kids.
See what makes Minnesota the Star of the North. New residents share why they love calling it home at exploreminnesota.com/live.
Are you on the hunt for a new home this spring, but don't know where to start? Fisher Homes is your solution. Your new home should reflect you, from the front door to the kitchen and even your outdoor space. Start your journey by selecting your ideal home site, like in a cul-de-sac or that's tree-lined, and then choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans. Bring it all together at our Lifestyle Design Center. Let Fisher Homes be your new home solution this spring and start making memories at fisherhomes.com.
Picasso knows your vacation home is your best home. It's the place that brings family and friends together. It's where you're the best version of yourself. Picasso makes it easy to co-own a luxury vacation home in amazing locations. Listings start at $200K for 1/8 ownership. Picasso does all the work for you. Luxury furnishings, maintenance, billing, scheduling, and more. And you can resell on Picasso's marketplace anytime, historically for a 10% gain. Visit Picasso to see thousands of listings. That's PACASO.com.
Hey guys, you know what this playground could use? A wine country, huh?
A redwood forest would be cool.
Ski slopes!
Wait! Did we just invent California?
Discover why California is the ultimate playground at visitcalifornia.com.